Today, we're going to finish off the last part of ontological models, which is to talk about Bell's theorem. it's quite an important topic. Most of this week, I want to be talking about interpretations of quantum theory. So I have a short section on the classical limit of quantum theory that we have to do between this and interpretations. But then the rest of the lectures this week, I'll talk about interpretations. We may get onto a little bit of talking about the classical limit today, depending on how quickly this last section goes. Okay, so let's talk about Bell's theorem. So if you remember earlier on in the course, we looked at this maximally entangled state, and we found that you get perfect correlations. So if Ellis and Bob measure this in the 0-1 basis, or indeed in any basis that's in the xz plane of the Bloch sphere, they'll get perfect correlations. So they always get the same outcome. And so if we remember about the EPR argument, according to orthodox interpretation of quantum theory, when Alice makes her measurement, Bob's outcome somehow pops into existence because this thing is not an eigenstate of Bob's measurement. So as soon as Alice makes the measurement and there's a collapse on Bob's side, that's when he has a definite measurement outcome. And that's a non-local effect because Alice is making the measurement over here causes Bob's outcome to kind of pop into existence. So the EPR argument says that in order to avoid non-locality, we must have the measurement outcomes pre-existing. And that's exactly how the toy theory model of entangled states works, right? All of the measurement outcomes are predefined. Okay, so then 1964, we have a problem with this kind of picture. So John Bell, here he is, showed that the correlations of entangled systems can't be explained this way. And we will explain a version of this, which is due to Clauser, Horn, Shimany, and Holt. It's actually the one that's most frequently used in theoretical analysis and even in most of the experiments today. So we'll look at that one. Okay, so when I teach this to undergraduates, I have them actually do this game. There aren't enough of us here to do it, so I'll just explain how it goes. So we can understand this in terms of a game. There are four participants here, Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Dora, okay? So what happens is, first of all, Alice and Bob get together for a few minutes to decide their strategy. Okay, so they have as much time as they like before the game starts to discuss how they're going to play this game. Then Bob leaves the room with Dora, and Alice and Charlie stay. The point is that they can't see each other or hear each other or communicate with each other while this is happening. So Charlie and Dora are there basically as referees. They're going to flip a coin. On the basis of that coin flip, when they see that coin flip, they're going to write down the outcome of the coin flip. Alice and Bob have to write down on the same piece of paper either +1 or -1 as their response. Okay, so they're going to see Charlie or Dora flip either a heads or tails. They're going to respond with a +1 or -1. Now, the condition for winning the game is the following. So if both Charlie and Dora's coin flips are either heads, heads, head, tails, tail, or tails, heads, then Alice and Bob have to give the same answer. So either they both say +1 or they both say -1. If that's the case, then they win that round of the game. If the coin flip is tails, tails, however, then they should give a different answer. So either +1, -1, or -1, +1. Okay? So they've decided the strategy for how they're going to approach doing this at the beginning of the game. And let me just emphasize here that they're really allowed to do anything, right? They can use as powerful computers as they like to generate their strategy. They can use randomness. They can flip coins, do anything they like, okay? So then we repeat this game for a number of rounds. And then finally, Bob and Dora come back into the room, and the referees, Charlie and Dora, they count how many times Alice and Bob won, as well as the total number of times they played. And their goal is to try and win this game, let's say 85% of the time. That's the goal. Question is, can they do it? Some of you have probably seen this before, but does anybody have an intuition as to whether they can do it or not? Okay, who thinks they can do this? Who thinks that they can achieve this? Okay, who thinks they can't? Okay, do you have a reason why?
Because we're doing this in the lead up to Bell's theorem,
which is
But I guess also it seems like they won't have enough information because of the heads, tails, tails, heads cases. Like,
right.
They really need to know what the other person has seen to be able to get this right.
Right, so the point is that there is a logical contradiction encoded in these conditions. So the easiest way to see it is graphically like this. I like to see it this way. Okay, so if we look at Charlie and Alice here, Charlie's coin flip can either be heads or tails. Okay, so we denote these nodes here represent Alice's answer in the case that Charles's coin flip is heads, Alice's answer in the case that it's tails. Similarly for Bob's answer here. Now, our conditions say that these solid lines means that those answers have to be the same, whereas the dotted line means that the answers have to be different. So let's just think about completely deterministic strategies for now, okay? So let's say, I don't know, let's start over here, and let's say Alice decides to have plus one here, then this line here says this also has to be plus one, this one says this also has to be plus one, this one says that also has to be plus one, and now we have a contradiction because these are supposed to both be plus one, but it should be different, okay? So the point is that however you go, you can repeat that with any assignment you like, but however you choose to go around this graph, you always find that you can satisfy three of the conditions, but the fourth one is impossible. It's a contradiction. Okay, so if we assume, because of course, you know, if Alice and Bob are very lucky, then Charlie and Dora's coin flips might be always heads, for instance, right? So there's a very small probability that will happen if we continue the game for a very long time. But if it did happen, then they can easily satisfy just that one condition. So if we assume that the coin flips are uniformly random, and you know we get a typical sequence of coin flips, then Alice and Bob can win this game at most 75% of the time in the long run. Because on each time, they'll have three out of four conditions satisfied. There's a one in four chance that they'll have to test each one of those four conditions, so they're gonna lose 25% of the time. And just in case you care, here are all the possible deterministic strategies that they can have. So plus means answer plus one, minus means answer minus one, and you can calculate how many of those, how many times they win, and all of the deterministic strategies either make them win 75% of the time or 25% of the time. Okay, so the best that they can do if they do a deterministic strategy is choose one of the 75% strategies. All right. So how about non-deterministic strategies? I've been talking about deterministic strategies. Will randomness help them? Now there are two ways they could possibly use randomness here, two distinct ways. First is they could choose let's not choose one of these strategies deterministically. Let's use classical randomness, say coin flips, dice throws, whatever, to choose it each time. So in each round of the game, or right at the beginning of the game, they're going to do a bunch of dice rolls and choose which strategy they use differently in each round of the game. So here, J, K, L, M, those are the answers that they give. These are Alice's answers for heads and tails. These are Bob's answers for heads and tails, and they're all plus or minus one. So I have to pick four binary variables, and I pick each of those strategies with a certain probability. Now, on each round of the game, obviously, they're still using one of these strategies, right? So the chances of winning in any given round of the game once they picked a strategy is obviously at most 75%, at worst 25%. So because the coin flips are also uniformly random, there's no pattern they can exploit in how those different conditions are chosen. It won't help them to average over strategies which have a maximum of 75%, right? So the average of a quantity can't be higher than the largest value, right? That's basically what it's saying. So to win this game, they won't do any better than just picking one of the optimal deterministic strategies. Okay, so that's fairly straightforward, but there is another way which somehow sometimes confuses people, because they could delay their decision. And this is important for the application to quantum mechanics, because obviously in some interpretations of quantum mechanics, we say that the outcome of a measurement isn't decided until it's actually made. It's genuinely random. Okay, so we might imagine that Alice and Bob tried to mimic this by, instead of rolling dice at the beginning, they're going to take some dice or coins to flip or whatever with them, and they're going to use the outcome of the classical randomness when they're separated with Charlie and Dora. They're going to use that to determine how they're going to answer. Okay, so here's how it would go. Alice is going to wait until she sees the outcome of her coin flip. She's going to decide nothing before then. If the outcome is heads, then she chooses to flip a biased coin which has this probability of coming up plus or minus. And if it's tails, she picks a different one. And basically, she uses the outcome of that coin flip to determine how she's going to answer. So she doesn't decide how she's going to answer until she's right there. And Bob's going to do similarly with two different distributions. But it's very easy to see that this just amounts to... So the point is that since they're separated when they're doing this, they can't do something that depends on what the other person has seen. Okay, they don't know whether the coin flip that... Alice doesn't know that whether the coin flip that Bob has seen is heads or tails. All she can do is respond to her own local coin flip that she's seen. So this just amounts to picking the deterministic strategy with these probabilities that are just the product of all of these probabilities here. And it's just, so we've already seen that picking a strategy with certain probability from this argument won't do any better. So it won't help them to have randomness at the beginning, and it won't help them to have randomness when they're giving their answers either. The point is that if we can do this in this way, then we could just generate this randomness right at the beginning, and it's just back to this, a special case of this. So when Alice and Bob are doing coin flips, once they've seen the outcome of Charlie and Dora's coin flips, when they're doing their own coin flips, they might as well have flipped both their coins, both the heads and the tails coin, they might as well have flipped that right at the beginning of the experiment, and then use that deterministic, that value that's now predetermined to determine how they're going to respond. That's basically what this says. It says you can pull back all of the randomness right to the beginning of the experiment. That make sense? So there's no way that they can use randomness that would help them do better than 75%. All right, so the way this is normally expressed is, remember I said in quantum foundations we like inequalities, so we're going to write down an inequality. So whatever strategy Alice and Bob use, which could be deterministic, non-deterministic, or they could delay their choice until they see the coin flips, their outcome probability is going to satisfy this inequality by the argument before. Okay, so we can satisfy at most three out of these four constraints. We want the heads-heads case, we want A and B. A and B are their outcomes. Want them to be equal, want them to be equal in these three cases, and they want them to be different in this case. And that has to be less than or equal to three. You can only satisfy three out of those four conditions in a deterministic strategy, and then averaging over randomness doesn't help. Okay, so that's a version of this, what's called the CHSH inequality. So now let's have a look at what happens in quantum mechanics. So now let's suppose that we allow Alice and Bob to take a quantum particle with them when they exit the room, and they can choose how to respond to the game by making measurements on their quantum particles. So those quantum particles can be maybe in an entangled state. So here's what we're going to allow them to do. So they suppose they take two qubits, it doesn't have to be qubits, but that turns out to be optimal anyway, in some joint state. Alice is going to take system A with her, and Bob's going to take system B. If Alice's coin flip turns out to be heads, then she's going to measure her system in some orthonormal basis, which is defined by a vector on the Bloch sphere that depends on whether it's heads or tails. So she has a two-outcome basis, and she's going to choose one of the basis vectors to correspond to the plus one out to the plus one answer, and the minus to the minus one answer. So she's going to make that measurement and choose how to measure how to answer based on that. And if she gets tails, if she sees tails, then she's going to measure in a different basis, potentially a different basis. And Bob's going to do the same thing with two other measurement bases, plus MH plus or minus and MT plus or minus. All right, so let's suppose that the state that they take away with them is this entangled state. Then you can compute for any two measurement basis directions. I suppose I should probably have, I'm going to let them be in the XZ basis. It doesn't matter too much, but we'll just have that. Yeah, so all that matters for these probabilities is that N plus, we choose the angle. Well, it's better to write it on the Bloch sphere. So if I look at the equator of the Bloch sphere here, then this angle, so if this is n plus and this is m plus, this angle phi is just the angle between the two here. Okay, so on the Bloch sphere, this phi is the angle between the two plus one outcome vectors, and obviously, since it's an orthonormal basis, minus m minus is down here, and n minus is down here. Okay, so if you take any two measurement directions you like, these are the outcome probabilities you can compute just simply using the mathematics of qubits, that this is what you get for those four possible outcomes. So we just have to choose measurement angles and see what we get. Well, obviously I'm cheating because I know what the best measurement angles to choose are, but here's what it looks like. So if we choose, these are Alice's measurements, the blue ones. So here's her, so NH is here. So this is like the plus one measurement direction, the minus one measurement direction will be down here. And when it's tails, we choose one that is at an angle pi by two. So this could be the Z spin measurement, for instance, and this would be the X spin measurement. And then for Bob's measurement directions, we choose them just rotated by an angle pi by four. So he's going to measure in this direction if he sees heads, and in this direction if he sees tails. Okay, so then we have to compute what are the probabilities that appear in the CHSH inequality. So first of all, we want the probability that A is equal to B given heads. And for that case, we're dealing with this angle. The angle between the two vectors here is pi by four. And we see that, well, you can get A equals B if they both answer plus or if they both answer minus. There's a probability that they both answer plus the probability that they both answer minus. So we go back to here and we see, okay, that's a half cos squared phi over 2. And this one is also a half cos squared phi over 2. So we'll get cos squared, the angle over 2. The angle is pi over 4, so it's pi by 8. And then we can use double angle identities to rewrite that in terms of cos pi by 4, which is 1 over root 2. And so that's the answer you get for that term. Okay. Now, The other three terms are actually the same. If we consider the heads-tails case, in the heads-tails case, we also want them to be equal, but the angle between, n heads and m tails is pi by 4 again. The angle's pi by 4, it'll be the same argument, we'll get the same value. And similarly for tails heads, in this case, n tails, m heads, that angle's again pi by 4. Now, the only case that's different is the case of tails tails. Here we want a to not equal b, and in that case, we want them to answer either plus minus or minus plus. Okay, so in that case, both of these are sine squared pi upon 2. Half sine squared pi upon 2. So in that case, we're going to get sine squared, but the angle between n tails and m tails is 3 pi by 8. 3 pi by 4. So dividing that by 2 is 3 pi by 8, but you can use the relationship between, if you shift by pi by 2, sine turns into cosine, and you get again cosine pi by 8, so it's again the same value. So all those four probabilities take the same value. And therefore, in the quantum case, we get 4 cos squared pi by 8, which is 2 times this, which is about 3.141. It's not pi, don't worry. It's nothing, but it's greater than 3. Okay, so the probability of winning is greater than 3. If I want the probability of winning, I have to divide this by 4. Because each of those possibilities happens with probability 1 over 4. So the probability of winning is that divided by 4. It's about 85.4%, which is the reason why I said 85% as the winning condition. Okay, so in quantum mechanics, we can win this game more times on average than we can classically. So that's actually the maximum possible probability in quantum mechanics. It's sometimes called the Stroessel bound. You can prove that for any measurement strategy whatsoever, or any initial state with any system, whatever, if they use quantum mechanical measurements on any system in any state, they can do at most that well. Okay. So any questions about that? That's the basic setup. Everybody happy? All right, so far I've just presented you with some game where Alice and Bob can't do better than 75% if they just use classical randomness, but they do better than that if they're allowed to use quantum randomness, measure correlations of an entangled state. But what does this have to do with non-locality or physics in any interesting way? So that's what we're going to talk about next. There is one topic before that. those of you who are familiar with the CHSH inequality will probably not recognize this form, so I'm just going to show you quickly how it's equivalent to what you normally see. So normally the CHSH inequality is expressed in terms of expectation values of observables rather than probabilities of outcomes. And the way that we can convert between them is to note that actually we've got four inequalities that we can use. The first one is the one we've seen, but note that if we go back to the deterministic strategies all the way back here, we have a lower bound as well, right? So we either, if you want to say, try to do as badly as possible as you can on this game, you always have to satisfy one of the conditions. You can't get away with satisfying no conditions. So there's a lower bound that in a deterministic strategy, one of those probabilities has to be 1. And so on average, the minimum here is 1. Okay, so this inequality is bounded between 1 and 3. And then note that I can also do this. So if I switch the roles of not equal and equal, so if I make this just these have to be equal and these three have to be non-equal, then that's still a contradiction in the same sort of way. So, if I go around here and say, okay, let's make this plus 1, that would have to be minus 1, that would have to be plus 1, that would have to be minus 1, which is different from plus 1, so it doesn't satisfy the fourth condition. So you get exactly the same pattern of contradictions if I switch the roles of equals or not equals. So I get this, I get this inequality here. So this is also bounded between 1 and 3. And I can multiply, let's multiply the whole thing by minus 1. That when you multiply an inequality by minus 1, you have to switch the direction of the greater than or less than signs. So I get this. Okay? That's my second two inequalities. So I've got this inequality, this pair of inequalities, and this pair of inequalities. And now we note that the expectation value of A times B, so remember A and B are observables that take values plus or minus 1, right? That's part of the setup. So their expectation value is if A equals B, then either they're both plus 1 or they're both minus 1, so their product is 1. And if A is different from B, then it's either minus 1 plus 1 or plus 1 minus 1, so their product is minus 1. The expectation value of the product of A and B is just the difference between these two probabilities. And therefore, you can see that if I look at each term here, this plus this is the expectation value of AB in the heads-heads case. This is the expectation value in the heads-tails case. I just sum each pair of terms. And then I get this inequality. So this is for the expectation value of AB in those four different circumstances, and that has to lie between 2 and minus 2. So that's the actual CHSH inequality that you see in the literature. And our quantum strategy, well, all you have to do is take the sums of these probabilities, and you find that you get 2 root 2, which is the usual violation. And that's what's usually called the Cyril sum bound. But the point is that all of that is mathematically equivalent to just working directly with the probabilities. So there's no need to be confused about those two different forms. All right. Okay, so now we're going to talk about what's the physical implication of this. So to do this, I have to go a little bit into the mathematics of causality and probability. The first thing is, I'm sure you're all familiar with these ideas, but just to note that there's a definition of two random variables being independent, means that their distribution should be a product. We have the usual definition of conditional probability, and so you can write independence equivalently by saying that the conditional probability of B given A is just the probability of B and vice versa. Now, the important notion that we're going to use is conditional independence, which you've probably seen. It just means that if I condition the probability distribution on C, then A and B become independent. So the conditional probability of A given B and C is just the conditional probability of A given C. So roughly speaking, is if I know C, I don't get any more information about A if I learn B. Okay. So all of the dependence on B is mediated by C in some sense. So these three forms of conditional independence, they're all equivalent. Everybody's seen that before, I assume, right? Is there anybody who hasn't? No, nobody's saying yes or no. Okay. So this is this notion we're going to use. All right. And then in philosophy, there's something that's called Reichenbach's principle. Now, scientific realists, if you're a scientific realist, most scientific realists think that if there's some correlation, it needs to be caused by something. Remember, when we're talking about ontological models, this is one of the reasons why we imposed lambda mediation, the idea being that the properties of the system are what causes the correlation between the preparation and measurement device. Okay, so this is usually assumed to have to follow causation is usually assumed to have to follow Reichenbach's principle. Okay. So suppose we observe two random variables that are correlated. It means that they're not independent. Then it could be for one of three reasons. It could be that A is the cause of B, right? Somehow A is directly the cause of B. So, you know, if I kick somebody and then they hurt, the cause of them hurting is me kicking them, right? So that's A is the cause of B. B is the cause of A, the other way around. Well, there's a third possibility, which is that there's a common cause for both A and B. And in that case, we expect them to be conditionally independent given C. So the idea here is that, I don't know, if I say something nasty, then both two students in the audience might both be crying. But the probability, if you condition on whether or not I've said something nasty, then the probability of any two students in the audience crying is independent, assuming that you don't cry just because of the quality of my lectures or anything like that. Now that's the basic example. There's some common cause which explains the correlation between the two variables. Okay, and this is going to be the case that's most interesting to us, of course. All right, so there's sort of a more powerful language for talking about this these days that I think it's quite useful, which is we talk about causal networks. They're a type of Bayesian networks. So here's the idea. The variables that we're interested in are represented by nodes in a graph. And we put an arrow if this thing can be a direct cause of that thing, okay, in some sense. So here's the idea. Suppose you have an alarm system in your house and you notice that there's an alarm going off. It could be because it's a burglar alarm, so there's a burglar in the house, or it could be because there's a fire in your house if you also have a fire alarm. Suppose those two alarms sound the same, right? We imagine that whether there's a burglar in the house or whether there's a fire in the house are more or less independent. Okay, a burglar could set off a fire, but we're not considering that here. So the idea here is that, okay, here I have two variables which have no parents, so I just write down the product of those distributions, and then I write down the distribution of this conditioned on its parents in the graph, okay? So the idea of what this graph says is that the correlation should be like this, and it says basically that the correlations between these three variables should have a causal explanation in line with Reichenbach's principle. So let me say that a bit more formally. So what does this mean? So first of all, we draw a directed acyclic graph. It means that these arrows have a direction from cause to effect, and it shouldn't be possible to, by following arrows, go around in a cycle. Right? So we're not allowing causal loops or closed time-like curves or anything like that in this kind of description. So we draw an edge from A to B if we're going to think of A as a direct cause of B. And then the probabilities have to factorize according to this condition. So if I write down all of the variables, probability of all of the variables, then I just write down, okay, I start with variable x1. It's got a conditional probability given its parents, so the things pointing into it. And I just take the product of all of those things. So this denotes parents. And if the node has no parents, as in this case, then this set here is empty. And so I just get the raw probability in that case. Okay, so that's the definition. And let's look at another quick example. You'll see how this works. Okay, let's start with node A. Node A has no parents, so I just get P of A. I'm going to go to node B here. B has one parent, which is A, so I get P of B given A. C has one parent, which is A, I get P of C given A. D has two parents, B and C, so I get probability of D given B and C. And E has one parent, which is C, so I get probability of E given C. And that's what the joint probability distribution has to be like. So this Markov condition is basically just an encoding of the Reichenbach's principle, which says that correlations have to have causes. So is that, I know I went through that rather fast, but is that kind of clear what's going on? Okay, so how is this relevant to Bell's experiment? So let's suppose that the coin flips, right? So Bob and Dora's coin flips and Alice and Bob's answers actually happen at space-like separation, okay? So, now, Alice and Bob's wings of the experiment are now space-like separated. So according to special relativity, these two events here cannot be direct causes of these two, neither the other way around, okay? So that since there's no superluminal influence, we rule out by special relativity the idea that these two variables could directly cause those ones or vice versa. So if they're correlated, and we do observe that they're correlated in the quantum experiment, then it should be because there's some common cause, all right? And the only place where a common cause can live according to special relativity is in the backward light cone, right? So if we look at the backward light cone of these events here, then any common cause of these two and these two has to live here, right? Has to be something that in space-time is determined at that point. So we'll just let lambda, which is playing the role of our ontic state as an ontological model, be a complete description in any region. We can make it any region that screens off these two. This is just an example of such a region. I could make this region slightly larger. I could do other things. I could say, okay, let me take a space-like hypersurface through here and say lambda has to be a description on that space-like hypersurface. Or I could, you know, even allow lambda to include some of the backward light cone that isn't in the intersection. The point is that so long as lambda is sufficiently large to contain anything that could be a common cause of both of those things. So this region here is kind of minimal for that. Right? So what do I mean by saying it screens off? I basically mean that if I go along a light-like path from these variables to these variables, I should have to intersect that region, right? So I can take a backwards directed, you have to be careful. The light-like path is not allowed to go into the future because we're not allowing causes from the future. So if I take a light-like path from here to here that goes through these backward light cones, it has to, any light-like path or any actually, path that a massive particle could take either, has to go through this region if it goes via the past. Of course, there are paths where I could go via the future, but that's not allowed as that would represent a common cause in the future, which we don't want to allow. But if I go via the path, I always have to go through this region. So that means that any common cause of these two variables and these two variables must be contained in this lambda, whatever it is. Okay, so according to special relativity, here are the possible causal relationships, right? So I can have X being a direct cause of A because it's past there, and Y being a direct cause of B, but any correlations between these two wings must be mediated by some common cause. So it must have some influence on all these variables. And that means according to our Markov condition that we have to have a decomposition that goes like this, according to that graph. Okay? So that's what special relativity tells us must happen if we believe the Markov condition. Okay, but now we normally assume something stronger, which is that lambda somehow doesn't influence these coin flips. This is just the measurement independence assumption that we already talked about in the case of ontological models. So we normally assume that the coin flips are freely chosen independently from the system being measured. So what you might imagine doing, for instance, is you could set the outcome of this coin flip to be determined by, I don't know, the weather in Shanghai. Like go on the internet and look up the weather in Shanghai, and that seems to be outside the influence of this, right? It's possible that there's some complicated correlation between the two that we don't know about, but we have sufficient reason to imagine that the weather in Shanghai is independent of what's going on in our laboratory here. Okay? So that's the idea. So the idea is that we can choose these to be independent of lambda. So that leads to this additional condition that actually these influences don't exist, basically what it's saying. There's no correlation between the ontic states of the that are going to cause our measurement outcomes and the coin flips. Okay, so we assume that, and then we get this decomposition. Okay. Now, okay, so this is the decomposition we've derived, and now we can condition this distribution on x, y, and lambda. Why do we do that? Because x, y, and lambda are the things that, x and y are the things that we control, and a and b are the things that we observe. So it normally gets written like this. If you condition on x, y, and lambda, you basically just have to divide by px, y, lambda. But those are in the product distribution, so that just kills these three terms, and you get this. So this condition is called local causality. It was the condition that was used in the that was originally used in the derivation of the CHSH inequality. So to reiterate, here's what it follows from. First of all, the Markov condition. So basically, the idea that causes have to have, that correlations have to have causal explanations. The causal structure given by special relativity, so the fact that we're doing these things at space-like separation, means that you can't have a direct causal influence. It has to be a common cause. And then the measurement independence, the assumption that x and y are chosen independently of the system being investigated, then we get this. Okay, there's three assumptions. Okay, so if we want to compute the observed probabilities, then we have to take this distribution and marginalize over lambda, conditionalize on x and y. So then you'll get this, okay? So let's think about what this says in terms of the CHSH game, right? So I can translate this into game terms now. So let's say Alice and Bob get together to determine a joint strategy to play the game. Let's call that joint strategy lambda, right? So Alice and Bob can choose that strategy probabilistically if they like. So they may flip coins with this, with these probability outcomes and choose a lambda. Then Alice and Bob take lambda and they go off to their two wings of the experiment. And they can, at the wings of the experiment, that strategy may only be a probabilistic strategy, may tell them to flip further coins, right? So based on lambda and x, Alice is going to flip a biased coin to determine A with probability this. That's exactly what this term says. That's exactly what we had before. And based on lambda and y, Bob flips a biased coin to determine his outcome with that probability. This is exactly the set of strategies that we were discussing earlier. Alice and Bob can use randomness at the beginning. They can use randomness when they've seen the coin flip. But if it satisfies this condition, that's the set of strategies. And that's exactly the set of strategies we showed already have to satisfy the CHSH inequality. Therefore, the fact that quantum mechanics violates this rules out local causality. Means that one of these three things must be wrong. Now, we usually call this effect non-locality, which is basically saying, well, somehow this is wrong. Okay. Note, however, there are assumptions going in there, right? There's even a fourth assumption which I haven't stated explicitly, which is that it's appropriate to model our uncertainty by using classical probability theory. But that's usually part of the realist framework. Okay, so if you accept the Markov condition and you accept measurement independence, then there has to be a superluminal causal influence in order to reproduce those quantum predictions. So for example, it could be that there's some direct influence from the measurement setting here, or the coin flip here, to Bob's outcome. If Bob is allowed to make his outcome depend also on what Alice has seen, then we can easily win the game. Actually, in that case, you could easily win the game all the time, and then it becomes a puzzle why we only get 85%. Okay. And this says that, well, your model just violates relativity at the ontological level. It means there are superluminal influences in nature. However, we can't use these superluminal influences to send a signal, right? So you can't send a signal by making measurements on an entangled state. And why can't you do that? Well, it's sort of the usual explanation that I've already been given, right? So if I have some feature on the ontological level, but you don't see it at the operational level, it's because the response functions or the conditional probabilities don't give you full information about lambda. So our measurement devices don't give us full and complete information about lambda. They only give us some coarse-grained information. And they have to be set up in such a way that the, you know, if you had full access to lambda, you could use this to signal, right? You could set X in such a way that B depends on it and send a superluminal signal. But it has to be that the influence of lambda is such that when I average over lambda, I lose that ability. I have to set the probabilities of this model in such a particular way. So arguably, that's a fine tuning. Okay, so what are the options here? So if you could reject the Markov condition itself, right? Say correlations don't need causal explanations. This option is somewhat appealing to anti-realists. You know, they just reject the idea that we need causal explanations. Causal explanations are sort of part of realism, that there has to be something mediating. You could try and modify the Markov condition somehow. You could say, well, causal explanations don't, we still have them, but they work differently in quantum theory. Actually, some of us are working on this kind of approach right now. And the idea here is that it's inappropriate to use classical probability. If you use a quantum version of non-commutative probability, then you can see that you still get an appropriate Markov condition. You could also reject measurement independence. Measurement independence is usually amounts to a no free choice assumption. So rejecting measurement independence is sometimes called superdeterminism, because you have to imagine that there's some common cause in the past, perhaps back at the Big Bang, which predetermined what your measurement choice here was going to be so that it was correlated with lambda in an appropriate way. That's usually seen as pretty implausible, although there is at least one very famous advocate of this approach who's Gerard Tuft, Nobel Prize winner. But there's another way of violating measurement independence, which is to reject the idea that causes always have to go from past to future. You can have causes from future to past, then you can imagine that it's actually the measurement setting here that's influencing lambda, which is at least keeps everything confined within the laboratory. Yeah.
I thought I heard that there was some experiment that like ruled out superdeterminism by using distant galaxies that had never been in causal contact.
Yeah, so let's say, okay. So you can never rule out the following, right? Which is that at the Big Bang, everything was basically more or less in one spot. So even those galaxies that are now very, very far away. So if you imagine that all of these correlations were somehow predetermined at the Big Bang, you're never going to rule that out, right? So there's an assumption that, you know, okay, well, in the Big Bang, things were more or less, like, apart from gravity, everything else was more or less thermalized. There actually weren't any such correlations around, right? That assumption is going on there, that any correlations sort of came since. So it rules out some classes of superdeterministic model, but not the whole idea. You can never really rule out the whole idea. And also, it doesn't rule out this idea, which is that the causes are actually going from future to past. Because then it doesn't matter how far away the galaxies are, because you're imagining that it's your measurement settings that are influencing the thing. It doesn't matter how you choose the measurement settings then. So you can't rule out all cases of violating measurement independence. So I think that experiment was perhaps a little bit overhyped. Did it rule out any theory that anybody has actually proposed? Probably not. But then not very many people are looking at these kind of ideas anyway. All right. Okay, so let's summarize ontological models. So suppose our interpretation of quantum mechanics is going to fit into the ontological models framework, then it's going to have a number of features which I argue would be unappealing. At least they're features that you can't that rule out something like a Speckens toy model, psi epistemic model. You're going to have this excess baggage. So more information way more information in a qubit than you can extract from it. Contextuality, things that are operationally equivalent are different ontologically. Reality of the wave function is still a bit of a case in debate, but the evidence seems to be going towards that. And non-locality, most people, out of these ones, most people are most bothered by this, of course, because violating special relativity is considered quite a bad violation of fundamental physics. So in light of this, we have two options. One is to like say, look, I need a realist interpretation. Realist interpretation essentially means it has to be in the ontological models framework. So all of these things have to exist. Yabu sucks to you, right? So we view the no-go theorems as justification for why our model has to have these features. And we just say, well, look, here's the most natural class of models that has all these features. And this will be the option taken in de Broglie-Bohm theory and spontaneous collapse theories. But then there are sort of two other things. Basically, we have to the other option is to just adopt the ontological models framework entirely. And there's two ways of doing that. One is to sort of become an anti-realist, go somewhere more down the Copenhagen type route. Or you could just adopt a more exotic ontology that doesn't fit into this framework. And that's what happens when you sort of go in the Copenhagen-ish or the many worlds type of view. And these are probably like the four main interpretations that get discussed a lot, right? It's not that there are no other interpretations of quantum mechanics. There's dozens and dozens of them, but these are what I would argue is the big four currently. So those four we're going to look at later on in this week. But we've still got 8 minutes left, so I'm going to start talking a little bit about the classical limit. But before I do that, are there any questions about any of this stuff? We're now finished with the ontological models section. Okay. Let's look at the classical limit. Why do we have to look at the classical limit? Not because I'm deeply, deeply interested in the classical limit, but because it's very relevant for how we construct our interpretations. So we're going to look at the classical limit of quantum theory. I'm not going to go through this in excruciating detail, deriving absolutely everything. What I want to do is give you an overview, enough that's relevant, that you could then go and fill in the details yourself if you want. So we're going to look at some ideas which have to do with the classical limit of quantum theory. Classical limit of quantum theory is one of these areas that's also fraught with controversy, and there are multiple different approaches. This partly has to do with the confusion about interpretations. So I'm not going to be able to tell you everything. So I'm just going to focus on a few key ideas that you see often, some of which don't work and some of which do work. Okay, so let's look first of all about what we mean by the classical limit of quantum theory. Right. So one of the requirements of the interpretation of quantum theory that I mentioned was that it should save the phenomena. In particular, this means you have to understand why the macroscopic world looks classical to us. Why is it that there are tables there? Why is it that particles obey classical laws of motion, etc.? There are several aspects of the classical limit. Some can be dealt with independently of interpretation, and some cannot, right? So the ones that are independent of interpretation, that's what we can really address now before we've talked about interpretations. So let's look at those. So I think there are three main aspects of the classical limit. One is we want phenomena that are sort of typical of quantum mechanics to disappear or be unobservable. I'm going to go through this in a little more detail. Actualization of quantum measurement outcomes. When you make a measurement, you want there to be one thing or the other thing. And there's also the recovery of the equations of classical mechanics. So let's look at those in a bit more detail. So disappearance of quantum phenomena. So in the classical limit, you expect that typical quantum mechanical phenomena should disappear or become effectively unobservable. So quantum interference of particles, particle-like objects, things that are particles classically, should disappear. Of course, if we're talking about photons, you want interference to stay around, just become the usual interference of electromagnetic waves in that case. Incompatibility of observables. So classically, we can measure position and momentum together as accurately as we like. Effectively, we end up with a sort of commutative algebra of observables. So how does that happen? Things like contextuality and non-locality disappear too. Of course, if we manage to get rid of quantum superpositions somehow, then you're naturally not going to be able to perform the experiments that would show those things. Okay. So taken together, this basically says that you should be able to describe your experiment entirely by classical probability theory, right? There's some classical, in the double slit experiment, for instance, you want to be able to say there's a classical probability of going down this path or going down that path, and they don't interfere with each other. Just use ordinary rules of classical probability. So this effect can be understood independently of interpretation, why we can't do this. So that's one of the things we can discuss. Actualization of measurement outcomes. I mean, this is sort of, in some sense, the hard part of the measurement problems. So if we've solved this question, then it effectively means that we're able to describe our experiment in terms of classical probabilities. But how do we know that those probabilities can be interpreted the same way as we normally interpret classical probabilities, right? So normally, if I say, you know, if I flip a coin and put it under my hand here, and I say there's probability half of it being heads, probability half of it's being tails, it really is either heads or tails, I just don't know which. That's my interpretation, it's classical uncertainty. So even if we've managed to get rid of interference somehow, and we can specify in a Schrodinger's cat experiment that it's perfectly okay to assign probability a half to cat alive, cat dead, and I know that there's no way on earth I'm going to be able to perform an interference experiment that would show a superposition, still, we've just had a formal mathematical limit at this point. At this point, I still do not know that this describes a situation in which either the cat is dead or it is alive, and we simply don't know which. All I've done is mathematically show that the interference disappears. So it could still be that the cat is in some kind of indefinite state until we actually observe it. That would be another interpretation of classical probabilities, and you can't rule it out unless you know what's real, right? So unless I've posited what is the ontology, what really exists, then I can't tell the difference between classical uncertainty and this. So this is really a problem for interpretation, is to say, okay, we've got these classical probabilities, what are these classical probabilities referring to? Just measurement outcomes or really something real? Really a cat that's either alive or dead? So that will be a job for interpretations to solve that part. But of course, all interpretation is going to make use of this mathematical stuff to make the argument for why it works. So that's why we have to study it first. Now, the third issue is you should be able to identify quantities that obey the equations of classical mechanics. But note, what are the equations of classical mechanics? Classical mechanics has a number of different formalisms. You can choose any of them that you like. But the important thing is that we have two types of classical theories. One, a theory which describes our uncertainty about classical variables, as we use in, say, statistical mechanics. We talk about probability distributions over classical variables, or a theory of the trajectories themselves, right? So in classical physics, we have the Liouville equation. Liouville equation describes how a probability density on phase space evolves. So you have some uncertainty about the positions and momentum of some particles described by a probability distribution. How does that evolve in time? It evolves according to this equation with the Poisson bracket. And there's also, however, the trajectory limit, which is to say, let's track the evolution of the canonically conjugate variables themselves. Let's track how points in phase space move around. Okay? The question is, do we need to just understand the theory of our uncertainty, or do we need to actually get the trajectories out of quantum mechanics as well? And this is an interpretation. So this is one of the reasons why there's confusion about the classical limit. It's because People are confused about whether they ought to be getting this or this. So let's think about it. Suppose your theory is psi complete. It means the wave function evolving unitarily is all there is. That's all you're ever going to have. Then you need to be able to get the trajectory limit, because we do indeed, you know, if you look at a particle in a simple harmonic oscillator, for instance, it really does follow a classical trajectory, and I need to derive that. Right? So if the quantum state is all there is, you need to derive the trajectory limit. If you're in a psi epistemic theory, then you have repeatedly been making the analogy that the quantum state is more like a probability distribution than it is a phase space point. Quantum state is having the same status as a probability density, so we expect it to behave like a probability density in the classical limit. Whatever travels along the trajectories is not included in the description of standard quantum theories. It's either some kind of extra hidden variable, it's either some hidden variable like in the Speckenstoy theory, or it's we somehow, if you're a Copenhagenish, you want to somehow say that the trajectories come from are observing things in some sense. Now, what about if you're in a psiontic interpretation but not psi complete? Then it's actually completely non-obvious, at least to me, which of these limits you should expect. Because the quantum state, so in something like de Broglie-Bohm theory, you have positions of particles in addition to the quantum state. The positions of particles, obviously in the appropriate limit, have to obey the classical equations of motion. But I'm not going to be able to get that until I have de Broglie-Bohm theory. Not going to be able to get that from the wave function on its own. What does the wave function have to do? No idea, because all I care about is what the particles do. Don't see the wave function directly. Okay, so in this kind of interpretation, it's completely non-obvious what to expect. But in any case, sometimes we might get a trajectory limit and sometimes we might get a alluvial limit. And the question is, should we care whether we manage to get the trajectory limit always? That depends on what you think about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Okay, so if you can only derive a alluvial limit and not a trajectory limit, then a psi completist might say, oh, that's a failure of classicality, whereas a psi epistemicist might say, oh no, that's perfectly fine. So you can see this is a difficult question. So next time we will actually start going through the mathematics of how you get these limits. At least take half a lecture or so on that. Any questions? Okay.